Yeah, he'd been doing press for Queen and Slim for a week, and so he'd been away from the shoot for a week. He hadn't played Fred in a week, and he woke up late. It was the only time he woke up late, and I know he was nervous. And he walked into the church, and we just, I mean, I can't express how that day is really. We had a lot of moments on set where, we kind of felt confirmation that we were doing the right thing, but none quite like that day, because it almost felt like everyone was trapped in a time warp, and everyone was treating him like Fred that day. I mean, the first take, he came up those steps, and just the way that the crowd greeted him, it really did feel like, Fred Hampton just came out of prison and was welcomed, with open arms by the community that loves him. And that energy that they gave to him, he fed off of, and it just became a it ceased to become a performance, specifically in that scene. It really became, just a very real thing.
It's an astounding moment. I also want to go to Lakeith Stanfield, who plays William O'Neill, the FBI informant in Judas and the Black Messiah, speaking in a Q&A with SAG-AFTRA.
I think there's just nuances to characters, and so I don't know. I always try to keep that in mind, that there was some love in O'Neill, even though he may have done things that we don't understand and agree with. I had to find that love, and it wasn't always easy. I'd be crying and telling Shaka, like, yo, I don't know what the is this. Especially when we got down to the scenes where I had to make a decision to like poison Fred or whatever, I was up about that. I couldn't even keep it together for the scene because I was just like, man, everything just felt so real. So I just had to find the truth in it and try to move and trust in that.
Keith played William O'Neill. What you want people to take away from this film, Shaka, and the significance of getting it out to this mass audience?
A number of things. I think one of the reasons to make O'Neill a central character is, to me, in a lot of ways, in terms of his storyline in the movie, about the dangers of being apolitical, and not only how it can lead to deep manipulation and one destabilizing a movement, but William O'Neill's life came to a bitter end, because of the decisions he made. They didn't just hurt other people; they ultimately hurt him, even though he, made them in a very self-serving manner. I think there's also obviously a desire to, make it clear that the Panthers, were largely motivated by love of each other, love of their community, love of their people, and to kind of correct the historical record that, these weren't like
You're listening to
terrorists.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, medical eye care, and eyewear from independent designers. Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at eyepdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Measure 110 takes effect today in Oregon, decriminalizing the possession of small amounts of restricted drugs. Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt was doxxed by a PPB officer last year as retaliation. And teachers are kicking off Black History Month with a week dedicated to sharing educational resources to fight racial bias and injustice in schools. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 1st, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 707 new cases of COVID-19 on Saturday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 142,416. This is the 14th consecutive day that the state has reported fewer than 1,000 new cases, a milestone that has not been reached since November of last year. Oregon health officials also reported 19 new deaths on Saturday, raising the state's death toll to 1,957. The agency said it would not be providing a COVID-19 report on Sunday due to server maintenance. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases with 122, followed by Washington County with 82. There are 280 people hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide, including 67 people in intensive care units. More than 400,000 doses of a coronavirus vaccine have already been administered in Oregon. Nationally, more than 26.2 million people in the U.S. have been infected with COVID-19. At least 442,000 people have died across the country. A federal order requiring passengers and crew to wear masks on most modes of shared transportation in the U.S., including planes, trains, buses, and other public transit, will go into effect Monday at 9 p.m. Pacific time as part of the Biden administration's effort to stop the spread of COVID-19. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 148,000 cases per day in the U.S., a decrease of 32% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 103.2 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.2 million people have died across the world. Oregon's new law that decriminalizes possession of small amounts of restricted drugs goes into effect today. People will instead receive a citation and have the option to seek treatment. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
One of the country's biggest rollbacks of restrictive drug laws goes into effect today in Oregon. In November, voters passed a measure that decriminalizes possession of small amounts of drugs, making it the first state in the country to do so. Tara Hurst heads the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance. She says possession will go from a misdemeanor to a citation, and on that citation will be a number to call for recovery help.
The options will be to pay a $100 fine or call a 24-hour, 7-days-a-week phone line and talk to a peer support specialist and get a social services needs screening done.
Hurst says they then can be connected to someone in their community. Services for treatment options are funded through a portion of marijuana tax revenue. Critics of the new law say it's flawed and are particularly concerned with how it will play out for youths, since there is no language on whether their parents should be notified. The law's Oversight and Accountability Council is forming today as well. Hearst says it will determine rules for the new law and also where grants and money are dispersed.
Really focus on communities most harmed by the war on drugs. So in Oregon, that's Black, Indigenous, Native, Tribal, and Latinx communities, and then people with lived experience, incarcerated for drug use, and people in recovery.
Hearst says a lot of states are interested in what happens with Oregon's decriminalization law.
You needed somebody to jump in the pool, and now I think people are watching to see how it goes, but also really excited by the momentum that this created.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt has been in office for 6 months after winning election by 77% of the vote. A retrospective by Oregon Live reveals that Schmidt was doxxed last year, allegedly by a Portland police officer. His home address was made public. Small groups of right-wing protesters showed up at Schmidt's house, where he lives with his wife and two children. This was just after Schmidt had been thrust into the national spotlight by former President Trump in his response to protests against systemic racism and police brutality over the summer. Schmidt was elected on a platform of racial justice, and in August, he announced that he would not be prosecuting low-level protest-related offenses, like disorderly conduct and interfering with a peace officer. Schmidt says that prosecuting those cases takes significant resources, and that often those charges have the potential to interfere with free speech. Advocates say that Schmidt has done a good job using his position as a check on heavy-handed police tactics. Nkenge Harmon Johnson is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Portland. Harmon Johnson told Oregon Live, quote, "I think Mike Schmidt has done more to meet this moment than any other prosecutor in the state. He's the top of the heap." Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, a Portland public housing contractor called Income Property Management keeps filing evictions. Home Forward, which manages hundreds of other units, has filed to evict just 11. Home Forward is the state's largest provider of affordable housing and has earned a reputation among many local tenant attorneys and advocates as refreshingly tolerant with the vulnerable tenants it serves. However, the property management company that Home Forward contracts with for much of its nonprofit housing stock takes a different approach. Since April of 2020, Income Property Management has filed to evict 30 households out of Home Forward properties that it oversees. This has earned Income Property Management the distinction as the region's top evictor since the eviction moratorium went into place last year. The company has filed 63 total evictions, with just under half coming from properties the company manages for Home Forward. The Public Housing Authority manages about 2,400 units and contracts out the rest of the 6,000 units it has in Portland. Because there's a moratorium on evictions for missed rent during the pandemic, all of these evictions are for cause, meaning the property manager believed the tenant violated their lease due to something other than non-payment. Some of the evictions filed allege serious infractions, such as assault and theft, while others list less severe offenses, such as loud yelling and the repeated burning of sage. The bulk of the evictions come from properties that serve low-income Portlanders. Tenant attorneys and advocates argue the most likely reason for the disparity in eviction rates is that Income Property Management, a for-profit company, does not have the same incentive to avoid evictions as Home Forward, whose stated mission is to keep vulnerable people in their homes. Some attorneys say Income Property Management is an egregious enough actor to warrant singling out and additional scrutiny from the Housing Authority. Nike has announced that they are vacating their 280,000-square-foot office space in Sunset Quarter at the Tektronix campus in Beaverton. According to a report from the real estate firm JLL Capital Markets, the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic has led to a rapid decline in demand for office space not seen in past recessions. The firm said, quote, "A growing number of small to medium companies have let their leases expire, while much of their workforce is still working from home." JLL says about 15% of Portland area office space is currently vacant. However, there have been major leases signed across the region, including one by Microsoft, which plans to move into an 84,000 square foot space in Hillsboro. JLL argues that leases like that demonstrate the Portland area's potential to provide ample office space to tech companies. The report added that the leases, quote, "highlighted the metro's position as a competitive alternative to its larger West Coast neighbors, which are experiencing comparatively worse fallout from the pandemic," end quote. The real estate firm predicts that vacancies will continue to rise, with Nike leaving another 200-square-foot office space in 2021 and a number of sublease availabilities turning vacant. At-home caregivers in Washington are negotiating their contract with the state. They're urging lawmakers not to scale back any of their gains during the pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
At-home caregivers for people with disabilities and older Washingtonians are holding the line in budget talks with the state. Individual provider members of SEIU 775 are negotiating their contract for the next 2 years. They don't want to be swept up in potential budget cuts during the pandemic. Caregiver Dora Pokey says the state contracts workers for certain hours, but they often provide care around the clock, especially if they're helping out a family member.
You're limited with the hours they do contract you for, and sometimes the second job, you're not able to work out of the house because these clients that we take care of, they require that hands-on.
Lawmakers have pushed back because of the unusual budget year during the COVID-19 pandemic. The state is looking at a $3.3 billion shortfall through 2023, according to a forecast from last year. SEIU 775 members' top priorities in contract negotiations include affordable health care premiums, no-cost personal protective equipment, and ensuring there's language barring harassment, abuse, and discrimination at work. Pokey believes agreeing to their contract would be more affordable than moving their patients to nursing homes.
The state is saying they can't afford to give us raises, right? But yet if they are put into a facility, the facility requires that 24-hour care. They're going to be spending more money at the facility than what we're asking for.
Pokey also says wages need to keep up with the cost of living.
We're already at a point where the cost of living has gone up. I mean, everything's so high right now. And for us to get any hours taken or cut would really affect us.
The workers' contract expires at the end of June. This is the second installment of a four-part series funded in part by SEIU Local 775. The third installment will run on February 8th and examines funding for nursing homes. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Educators are kicking off February, which is Black History Month, with a week dedicated to sharing educational resources to fight racial bias and injustice in curricula and schools. Lily Bolke has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Many teachers are joining a national campaign this week called Black Lives Matter at School to raise awareness about structural racism in the U.S. that's often not included in standard curricula. They're advancing an agenda for schools, from including more Black and ethnic studies in the curriculum to hiring more Black teachers. They also want to end zero-tolerance discipline policies and fund more counselors and social workers rather than school police officers. Dr. Monique Rideau-Smith is with the Illinois Federation of Teachers, curating race and racism lesson plans and Black History Month ideas.
Not just during this week, not just during this month, but year-round. And not just in schools that serve Black students or that serve students of color. We need to ensure that curricula is really a mirror and also a window.
Research shows Black students who have at least one Black teacher early in life, in kindergarten through third grade, are more likely to graduate from high school and attend college. And Rideau-Smith says white students benefit from learning from diverse teachers as well. Rideau-Smith describes it as, quote, healing when Black, Brown, and Indigenous students can see themselves in the curriculum and get opportunities to think about the issues that affect them in their communities.
And that allows for you to be more engaged in that curriculum, which means it's going to be less likely that you engage in behavior that might be deemed as disruptive, right? That could lead to police being called, security being called, you being pushed out of school.
Rideau-Smith adds police are more likely to be present in schools serving high minority populations and points out that more police violence is focused on people of color. She notes there's been a consistent increase of police presence in schools.
But we have seen a defunding of public schools in general. We've seen a lack of counselors, a lack of school nurses, a lack of social workers, and just staff who are educated in issues of trauma.
She hopes this campaign and others like it encourage policy changes so students get the message that their needs are worth investing in. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with radio host and author Tom Hartman about his new book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. We'll follow that up with Noise Filter, debunking COVID-19. Then at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 48. Today in history, in 1790 in New York City, the U.S. Supreme Court meets for the very first time, with Chief Justice John Jay presiding. The quote of the day is from American civil rights activist Rosa Parks, who said, quote, "I have learned over the years that when one's mind is made up, this diminishes fear. Knowing what must be done does away with fear." Senate Republicans have a plan for a COVID relief compromise, while loyalties are dividing the GOP. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are tracking our democracy in historic times.
We need political leaders to come together in a democracy to debate, discuss, come to consensus where possible, to take votes, because that's the way we make decisions in a free society.
Tennessee former Senator Bill Frist is a physician and Republican who left his leadership position after fulfilling his promise to serve only two terms. He's serving as co-chair of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Task Force on the Pandemic, which just released its own recommendations for a federal COVID response. With over 440,000 coronavirus deaths in the United States, the group of former elected officials, economists, and health advisors call for working together and trusting the science. Here's co-chair Gail Walensky, a health economist.
A very large number of Americans need to be made to feel that the democracy is working.
The task force recommendations align with President Joe Biden's plan, but maintain COVID-19 must be depoliticized for the federal response to be effective. that may not happen quickly, Democrats plan to pursue a budget reconciliation to pass Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan, reducing the Republican support needed. 10 GOP senators are releasing a new proposal for less than one-third of that amount, a $600 billion alternative. Former President Donald Trump named new attorneys for his second impeachment trial after five lawyers left over what they say was a mutual decision. The trial starts in a week. Jeffrey Verhoef, who served on the RNC's Finance Committee, believes Trump should be barred from future office, but he doesn't think the Senate will convict.
That's going to be a very difficult environment to also say to the American people, well, we're also doing COVID and we're also doing economic recovery. And I think it's going to bog the administration down.
More than 150 people have been charged so far for the Capitol insurrection January 6. Two members of the Proud Boys face federal conspiracy charges.
We are facing a crisis of democracy, the kind that we faced after the Civil War. And as a historian, I can see it.
Dr. and Professor Manisa Sinha is a Civil War authority at the University of Connecticut. She says for the future of the country, it's crucial that those who incited the violence be held accountable, including political leaders. Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger announced an effort to reclaim the GOP from what he calls fringe elements. He's one of just 10 House Republicans who voted for impeachment. Another Republican, former Florida Congresswoman Ayanna Rossley Tenton, says she's sickened that her party is associated with the insurrection and wishes more would stand up for GOP core principles.
A lot has to do with the great pull that President Trump still has in our Republican Party. Will he maintain that pull in these coming years or not?
Meanwhile, new numbers show that Trump has raised $255 million for his PAC since the election. More than 100 election-related bills are under consideration in 28 states, mostly Republican-sponsored and considered to be efforts to suppress voter access. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Acoma Pueblo in New Mexico files a lawsuit over the closure of emergency care services, and the Chugach Alaska Native Corporation requires land. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Pueblo of Acoma in New Mexico has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services over the closure of services at the Acoma Cañoncito Laguna Hospital located on Acoma lands. The lawsuit accuses the Indian Health Service of causing harm, especially during a pandemic when inpatient care and emergency services were shut down in November 2020. The tribe says an Acoma patient who tested positive for COVID-19 died before he could be transported to a hospital. The tribe claims the death is directly traceable to limited services. Pueblo of Acoma Governor Brian Vio told reporters Friday there are many other examples of serious harm to the community and says emergencies that would be handled by the hospital now have to be cared for at other locations as far as more than an hour's drive away from the Pueblo.
The closure has affected the lives of Acoma tribal members, compromising their mental health, and now increasing the financial burden for some. The actions of the Indian Health Service have created what looks and feels like third world conditions and not America in the 21st century. No other town, city, or civilized country would find this acceptable. Yet, it happens way too often in Native American communities.
The lawsuit accuses Health and Human Services of failing to abide by federal law and failing to use federal coronavirus funding to address Acoma's needs. Plans to reduce the hospital to an urgent care unit during regular business hours is expected to begin Monday, February 1st. Vio says the Pueblo is asking President Joe Biden and his administration to reverse the decision.
I truly hope the president will step in and order his Department of Health and Human Services and the Indian Health Service to put an end to this life and death situation and keep the hospital fully operational. Otherwise, we will have no other choice except to pursue the litigation we have filed to the very end.
The ACL Hospital has served the Pueblos of Acoma and Laguna and a Navajo community since the 1970s. The reduction of services comes as Laguna plans to open a new facility, which removed funding from the ACL Hospital. The Navajo community removed its allocation in 2016. The Indian Health Service did not provide a statement about the lawsuit. The IHS is currently without a director due to the presidential transition. Bio says the Pueblo realizes there's a transition, but is making sure to keep communication about the hospital going with the agency, other federal departments, the state of New Mexico, and members of Congress. The Chugach Alaska Corporation recently reacquired land that has been in private hands since the 1900s. The sale was announced in mid-January. The Native Regional Corporation purchased more than 150 acres of land from the Nature Conservancy, located at the mouth of the Copper River Delta near Point Martin, Alaska.
The Copper River Delta was such a, besides such a rich resource area, it was kind of the migration corridor for all the different cultural groups in Alaska.
That's John F.C. Johnson, the corporation's vice president for cultural resources. The region's a confluence of cultures, including Supiak, Tlingit, and Eyak, and Atna Athabascan people.
Your heritage and culture is priceless. I mean, what price you put on a grave up to your relatives? You can't put a price on it.
Johnson says the Heritage Foundation will work with cultural representatives from other surrounding Native groups to discuss future ideas on how to best utilize the land. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Warmer weather due to climate change is helping fleas and ticks become a year-round nuisance for pets as they stay more active and some move northward. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Cat and dog owners dread seeing ticks or fleas on their furry friends. These parasites can spread disease and make pets itchy and miserable.
It can be so bad that they cause lots of skin damage from their nails. They get secondary infections. They'll lose their hair. And overall, it's just a complete nuisance to the animal and the owners.
That's Brian Heron, a veterinarian at Kansas State University. He says fleas like warm, humid weather, so pets are most likely to catch them between spring and fall. But flea infestations can happen in winter, too, especially as the climate changes. As winters become milder, fleas stay active longer. And as conditions change, some species of ticks are expanding their ranges.
Where I'm at in Kansas, our predominant tick is the Lone Star tick. And in our area, it's a spring-summer type of tick. And so as the temperatures change, as it becomes warmer, as we have shorter periods of cold, then its range is actually moving northward.
So Heron recommends year-round flea and tick prevention, even if you live in the northern U.S.
That's really the safest way.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 1st, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan talks about the mobile technology experience, The Met Unframed, which runs for free on mobile phones through February 16th. All of these KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with Tom Hartman about his new book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Tom Hartman, progressive national and internationally syndicated talk show host on the radio like us. Welcome, Tom, to KBOO.
Hey, Jenka. Thanks for having me.
And now you are the author of a number of hidden history books, the hidden history of the Supreme Court and a number of others, and now the hidden history of oligarchies in the United States. And I wonder if you could begin by just maybe defining oligarchy and how it's different from democracy.
Sure. Well, democracy is where governance, the decisions that guide a society, are made by the majority of the people. Oligarchy is where governance is, and the decisions that guide a country are made by a small group of very wealthy people. My last book was about monopoly, a hidden history of monopoly. I think we talked about it. And that's when you concentrate economic power in a society. Oligarchy is when you concentrate political power in a society. So they're kind of bookend books.
Right. And you, in your book, talk about the last 40 years, the consolidation of power in the oligarchs beginning in the Reagan administration. But in a way, hasn't the U.S. always kind of been a country run by oligarchs, beginning with the white, wealthy, slave-owning men that started the country?
Yes, absolutely. And it's gone in waves. It's gone in waves from peak oligarchy. We hit a couple of major peak oligarchy waves, one in the 1850s and 60s, which led to the Civil War. The second one, big one, was in after the Industrial Revolution from the 1890 to 1930, which led to the Great Depression. And the third one in relatively modern history really started in a big way in 1980 with the Reagan Revolution. Prior to Reagan, in the period from 1940 to 1980, the middle class was actually growing faster. The wealth and income as a percentage for the middle class was growing faster than was the top 10% or even top 1%. Reagan, of course, reversed all that with his policies following basically what Warren Harding had done in 1920. And so between a Supreme Court decision, a couple of Supreme Court decisions in the 1970s that really brought Reagan to power and established this, and were followed up by Citizens United, and this 41 year now neoliberal experiment, we are really at peak oligarchy right now. Gillens and Page, a couple of researchers from Columbia University, did a study, a really good long-term study, and they found that prior to 1980, in the period from 1950 to 1980, when you looked at public opinion surveys on public policy versus legislation that got passed at both state and federal levels, what you found was that typically anything that had majority support in the bottom 90% of Americans became law. And the stuff that was supported by the top 10% of Americans, it could become law, but it wasn't quite as predictable as the bottom 90%. Post-Reagan, basically since 1988 or 89, the probability of legislation that's widely popular among the bottom 90% becoming law has been reduced to what they referred to as equivalent to random noise. In other words, there is no more democracy, essentially. What the people want is not what's getting made into law, but what the top, in particular the top 1% want, is made into law very, very often, well over 70% of the time. And so we're in not a full-blown oligarchy right now, but we're damn close to it.
And how does an oligarchy move into a state of tyranny? I know you give the example of Hungary and a lot of parallels there between the Trump administration and the oligarchy there.
Yeah, Viktor Orban's administration. Absolutely. A lot of this comes out of this conservative impulse. In 1951, Russell Kirk wrote a book predicting that, keep in mind, back then the middle class was growing faster than the rich, predicting that if the middle class continued to get wealthier and wealthier, it would hit a point where society would break down, where young people would no longer listen to adults, to their parents, where women would no longer submit themselves to their husbands, where minorities would be producing chaos in the streets, you know, et cetera. And everybody thought he was a crackpot, except William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater. But, you know, he published this book. And then the 60s happened, and the birth control pill was legalized in 61, and which produced the women's movement and you know, in the workplace. The civil rights movement was very, very active. Martin Luther King active during that time. Students were saying, no, we're not going to go to the Vietnam War. They were burning draft cards. And other minorities, you know, gay people, you know, there was a gay rights movement. All these things were happening. And at that point, the conservatives looked around and said, holy cow, Russell Kirk was right. Society is breaking down. We've got to strip some of this wealth out of the middle class. And now they thought they were doing the best thing for society, right? The Buckleys and Goldwaters and Reagans of the time, to stabilize American society. The problem is they set about doing it. You know, in just 12 years, Reagan and Bush destroyed about half the union jobs in America, started aggressively outsourcing our factories. You know, there's just this major change. And now somewhere between $10 and $20 trillion of wealth has been taken out of the pockets of the middle class and put into the pockets of the top 1%, which was supposed to produce this 1950s-like stability, you know, the June Cleaver world. But in fact, what it's produced is chaos. And out of that chaos come these opportunists, these fascist opportunists who say, well, we've got the solution. You just need more law and order. You just need more tough guy stuff. You just, you know, we just need to. And essentially, that's what happened in Hungary. That's what happened in Germany in the 1930s, coming out of the Great Depression and the Treaty of Versailles. In country after country after country, what you see is as the middle class gets shredded, it doesn't produce a return to stability. It flips a society into fascism. And that's the direction we're heading right now. And that's the direction, sadly, that the Republican Party seems committed to now that we see that Kevin McCarthy just went down to see Donald Trump and they're trying to purge the party of Liz Cheney, for God's sake. I'm very concerned that we're heading right straight toward full-blown fascism here in the United States.
Mm. And, of course, the 1950s, the stability there, well, and, of course, it was stability for certain races of people. There was certainly a lot of racism at the time. But it was built on the New Deal and the 90% tax rate of the time, not on the kind of oligarchic control that that you're talking about.
That's correct. Yeah, and in fact, tax policy was a major thing. You know, we had a 90% tax, top tax rate, top tax bracket, right up until Lyndon Johnson dropped it, I think in 67, and down to 74%. And then it was a 74% until the second year of the Reagan administration. So, you know, it's, and then, you know, when Reagan dropped it down to 25%, of course, that's when everything started to unravel.
And I just want to talk briefly about debt peonage. You talk about the reality of the 13th Amendment in which slavery was abolished except for those in prison. And, you know, we heard some about this system of debt peonage in Ferguson after Michael Brown was killed and the way that that municipality was funded on the debt of the very poor. And I wonder if you could talk. I was surprised to read in your book about Mississippi and restitution centers, which are essentially debtors' prisons. How deep does this go?
Oh, it goes all the way down. I mean, it's now a major for-profit industry. The 13th Amendment did not end slavery in the United States. I know we all learned that in elementary school, but in fact, if you read the amendment, it says slavery shall be ended except for punishment for crime. And in other words, it is still legal in the United States to hold a person literally as a slave, to enslave them, to force them to work and produce goods. And we have companies all over America that are using prison labor, that is the euphemism. It's slavery, are using prison labor to make profits. And then, of course, just using human bodies to make profits. You've got these private prison companies, particularly the ones contracting with ICE that Donald Trump was so fond of. It's a horror show. It really, really is.
And a lot of people think, you know, we kind of dodged a bullet in November by the election of Joe Biden. And yet 70 million ostensibly people voted for Donald Trump. I wonder if you could talk about how it is that so many people are willing to vote against their own interests. Are they just too propagandized to know what's true? Or they believe Trump's lies that he would tax the rich and, you know, pull back factories from foreign countries and replace Obamacare with a system that covered everyone? Is it the control of the media, as you talk about?
Yeah, that was Trump's main sales pitch, you know, was I am Bernie Sanders. And, you know, he said he was going to bring the factories back from the from China and Asia and Mexico, which Bernie and Sherrod Brown and a good chunk of the Democratic Party have been working on for years. You know, we have to kind of slap Bill Clinton upside the head for getting us in this situation. But he was just implementing policies that have been negotiated and treaties that have been negotiated by Reagan and Bush. You know, NAFTA and the GATT agreement that created the World Trade Organization. And, you know, so number one, Trump lied through his teeth saying that he was going to give everybody in the country health insurance and it would be less expensive and less complex than Obamacare. He said he was going to bring back our jobs and they would be good paying jobs and all that kind of thing. And it's just, it's as you point out, I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling that people were voting for a progressive agenda that Trump was presenting. It's why he was able to win the Republican primary, because Republican ideas are just so unpopular in general. And then he didn't follow through and you know, essentially was blaming it on everybody else. And now, see, this is, as a society, we're, you know, we have been watching our society being gutted. 41 years of Reaganism. And 10 years ago was the first time since 1951 that half of America was no longer in the middle class. We no longer even have, you can't even call it a middle class because it's not the median any longer. Half of America, more than half of America 10 years ago fell below the, you know, what was considered the threshold of middle class. We are a nation in poverty now as a result of 41 years of Reaganism. When people are impoverished, they do crazy things. They start looking for easy answers. They start listening to crazy conspiracy theories. For years, I did international relief work, and I did a lot of work in the Middle East and in Northwestern Africa. And you go into countries that are run by, that are basically oligarchies, or where the government is very unstable, and where there's, you know, widespread poverty, but not like, I'm not talking famine. I'm just, you know, like what we're experiencing in America right now, widespread homelessness, you know, food insecurity right now in America, 1 in 7 families, this was in the Washington Post, 1 in 7 families who are renters are not able to feed their children today in America. When you go into countries where the situation is like that, what you find is that news is mostly conspiracy theories. People don't believe the news. People don't believe the government. It looks to them like everything's falling apart. And so conspiracy theories come to consume the country and sometimes overthrow governments. And we're seeing that with, you know, these QAnon crazies right now.
And so people are susceptible to an oligarchic ruler because they are wanting stability?
That's correct. And safety. You know, they don't feel safe. You know, I mean, the United States is one of the least safe of the developed countries. We're the only of the 34 countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD countries, the 34 richest countries in the world. We are the only one that doesn't offer free health care or close to free health care to every one of its citizens as a right. We are the only one that doesn't offer free college or something close to free college. And in many of those countries, I mean, like in Denmark, they pay you $400 a month to go to college, we're the only one that right now out of the OECD countries, I think we're one of three actually, that are not making weekly payments to everybody in the country at a level of around a minimum of $500 a week. I mean, the entire rest of the developed world is taking care of their people. We are gutting our people. We have been doing this for 40 years. Part of the reason why Reagan did it was he thought it would, you know, return stability to America, that, you know, him and Lewis Powell and all these guys. But the other part of it was, by gutting the unions, he was also demonetizing the Democratic Party, and you know, which forced Clinton to create the DLC and start taking money from banks and insurance companies. So it's been a weird and twisted 40 years, but those of us who were yelling about it back then are looking around now going, yep, this is exactly, you know, and I just, for the book, it was not particularly difficult to document this arc.
Well, and in your book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, like Daniel Ellsberg writes, I learned something new on every page, something I should have known, you know, like I was appalled that 500,000 people have to declare bankruptcy for medical debt in this country when in a whole list of other countries you mentioned, zero people are claiming bankruptcy for medical debt. It's
right. We're the only OECD country where medical debt causes bankruptcy.
And a couple of days ago, you wrote that we're in an unacknowledged second Republican Great Depression. And you say only government can hold oligarchs in check. With so many politicians now either with allegiance to the oligarchs because of campaign contributions or being oligarchs themselves, how can we expect them to make the change necessary? Or I guess, how can we pressure them to make the change necessary?
Well, this is exactly, Jenka, why I think it's so important that that H.R. 1 and Senate Bill 1, this first piece of legislation, just like Nancy Pelosi got out of the House 2 years ago, is the first piece of legislation, is legislation that is going to force dark money to reveal itself. It's going to force the billionaires behind these various groups that are influencing politics to put their names on things. And it's going to limit the power and influence of money in politics. The thing that really turned us in this direction was the Buckley decision in 1976. Prior to 1976, it was basically illegal for a billionaire to own a politician. And in 76, the Supreme Court said, that's not corruption, that's not bribery, which is what we always used to call it. That's actually free speech. Money is the same thing as speech. And so if you want to give money to a politician and you're rich and the politician does you favors, that's free speech. And then 2 years later in the Bilotti decision, they extended that logic to corporations. And then in 2010 on Citizens United, they doubled down on it and expanded it. And that's what has been powering much that created the Reagan Revolution. It created an avalanche of cash in 1979 and 80 that brought Reagan into power, and it has sustained the Republican Party and to some extent the Democratic Party as well ever since. And right now it's roiling the waters. And so if we want to get back to democracy and back out of this oligarchy that we are three quarters of the way into right now, the first thing we have to do is get control of money in politics.
And another thing that you are suggesting is in breaking the oligarchy is prosecuting Trump. Now, one of the headlines that kind of got overshadowed in the last few weeks of many, many headlines is the Supreme Court deciding against allowing Trump to be tried for violations of the Emoluments Clause, in which he abused his position to make personal profit. Now, how could Trump still be prosecuted under the Hatch Act? Is that a possibility?
I doubt the Hatch Act would be the one you'd want to use, because, you know, it's a relatively small crime, using government property for political purposes. There are a bunch of people in his administration who could be prosecuted, you know, Kellyanne Conway at the top of the list, and Ivanka Trump, you know, with Goya Beans and all this kind of stuff. But I think that sedition is what he needs to be prosecuted for, among other things. And it looks like, you know, New York is going to go after him for tax fraud and real estate fraud and bank fraud and all kinds of things. The guy's been a grifter his entire life. He's a serial liar and a psychopath, frankly. And those kind of people can be very dangerous. We're seeing that right now in real time.
And we're going to have to wrap it up. I know your time is valuable. I appreciate you taking the time with us. I just wanted to follow up with this book was written, of course, before the election and before the events of January 6th. And I wanted to get your comments on the Capitol insurrection, which in some ways is an extreme of your example of the normalization of outrageous behavior that leads to tyranny.
Yeah. The last 3 weeks have been very concerning. The Republican Party following January 6th had a choice. They could either repudiate treason and going back to being a normal political party in a semi-functioning democracy, or they could fully embrace treason and become a full-blown fascist party like Marine Le Pen's party in France, or I forget the name of the party in Sweden, or the new AfD party in Germany, or Viktor Orban's party or Putin's party. And it sure looks in the last few days like they've decided to go in the latter direction, which I think is a very, very bad signal. I don't think people realize how dangerous that is. If the Republican Party goes fascist, it's entirely possible it can take the entire country with it.
And as an antidote, you do point out that humanity and human nature are inherently good. Democracy is hardwired into human behavior, and here's hoping we go in that direction.
Yeah, well, typically when countries go full fascist, it lasts for a generation, and then people wake up. Usually the fascists are defeated. We saw this in Japan and Germany, Italy and Spain during World War II, as a consequence of World War II, and you can see it over and over again throughout history. And we certainly have seen it in the United States with the rise of fascism in the South in the 1850s and 1860s, and we beat that back. So I'm still hopeful, but I'm very concerned.
Well, thank you very much for joining us again. We've been speaking with New York Times bestselling author Tom Hartman, also a talk radio host. His newest book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. You can find it at your nearest independent bookseller. Thank you, Tom Hartman, for joining us on KBOO today.
Thanks, Jenka. It's always great being here. I so appreciate your having me on your show.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19. So let's get started.
The following is the final part of our vaccine series, where we are reviewing the new vaccines here in the U.S., so enjoy this next segment. Changing directions a little bit, we wanted to take a few minutes to discuss the safety of the vaccines, Doc.
I've heard from family and friends that they're worried about something produced and tested so fast because we don't necessarily know the long-term health effects.
I've heard that too, and I understand that concern. However, the short-term safety data indicates that it's so far very, very safe. There have been a few isolated incidents of an allergic reaction, but there's no other issues associated with the vaccine. Remember that mRNA disappears very, very quickly.
Yeah, but what about the long-term? That's what people are concerned about.
Now, of course, since these vaccines have been developed over the past year, we don't really know if there are any long-term effects. So far, there have been no lingering side effects. What we do know, though, is that if you do get COVID-19, you can die. So even for those who recover, there are also even some long-term effects. So we're seeing widespread cardiac and lung complications after a bout of COVID, and those will likely cause health challenges and even possibly shorter life expectancy. So when we're weighing the rare allergic reaction with those severe and even fatal outcomes on the other, the medical community feels comfortable strongly suggesting that people do receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Additionally, just like with any other medication, the FDA will continue to monitor these vaccines to ensure continued safety profiles.
So far as we know, there are no negative long-term effects, but there are many immediate side effects.
Well, I mean, the side effects are similar to those of vaccines that we know of now. For example, pains in the arm with the injection, muscle aches, fatigue, headaches. These are symptoms that usually go away in a day or two. And to be clear, they're caused by that lipopolysaccharide envelope or shell that the mRNA is placed into. It just so happens that those are inflammatory-inducing particles. So we expect that to be part of the vaccine experience. And also, if you do feel pain in your arm or feel kind of crummy or headache, whatever that may be, it just means that your immune system is working.
Right, but we don't want you to think that if you don't have any side effects whatsoever, that it didn't work.
Right, those people who are a little bit more advanced in age don't have these side effects because their immune system is a little bit more compromised.
Yeah, before we started down
that. Youngums like you and I.
Down that, right, exactly. Before we started down that rabbit hole, because I could already hear the question, but wait, no. So there's another big question that I'm getting. I've already had COVID, should I go ahead and get the vaccine?
So that's a very interesting question, and it depends on whether or not you had confirmed COVID or not. If you never had a positive test, you should treat it as you never had it and get the vaccine.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
What if someone had the virus confirmed with a positive test?
The CDC do recommend that people get the vaccine even if they've already had COVID. Some cities, though, are having people get antibody tests before they're given the vaccine to ensure that those at the highest risk receive it first.
So if they have antibodies, they don't get the vaccine?
Not in the first round. People in this group will get it later. And honestly, although I would recommend all people get the vaccine as soon as they're able, if you've had COVID in the last few months, I would not be so worried if you're not able to get the vaccine in the first round. But also, let's be very clear. If you've had COVID in the past and it has been confirmed, one of the reasons, if not the primary reason, we want you to get the vaccine is that we want you to get a definitive, measurable dose response that the vaccine will give you that we know will protect you from reinfection in the future. So this is really making sure that everybody is going to be as protected as possible.
Okay, so one more question for now.
Okay.
How long will it last? Like, we get the vaccine. Is it going to be lifelong, or is it going to be like the flu where we have to get it every year?
So as we have said from the very beginning, you should judge your COVID vaccine advice for information, especially when it starts with, we don't know.
We don't know.
Right? Yeah. Because this is all really new. Yeah. But the current data is about 6 months old, and so far immunity is going strong. While it is possible that we would have to get the vaccine regularly in the future, if we don't get enough of the population vaccinated now, we can likely break the cycle of the pandemic and keep outbreaks small in the future, even if the vaccine wears off eventually. But I just want to be clear, though, that even though antibody levels will wear down, remember, Dr. Riggs, if you had a cold, you know, last November you had a cold, right? And let's say it was an adenovirus.
Yep.
I wouldn't expect you to have those same antibodies circulating.
No.
What I do expect, though, do have memory cells.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That remember that strain of adenovirus.
Yeah, and so, I remember that.
That's right. Yeah. So now I have a question for you.
What you got?
Who do you think should be vaccinated first?
Oh.
Me?
You went there. That's a really, really good question. There are two thoughts about this.
Okay.
One is the way that we've been handling it here in the U.S., vaccinating our healthcare workers first.
I actually think it's a good idea.
Yeah. And the other is how the U.K. has started vaccinating. They started with people who are most vulnerable, like those that are over 65.
So why should we do one versus the other?
The thinking behind vaccinating healthcare workers first is that they're the people with the most exposure. Makes sense?
Agreed.
Yeah. While the thinking behind vaccinating the most vulnerable first is that they would face the most devastating consequences should they get it. I hate to say it that way in science, but we'll have to see what works best.
Right. Is there any concern that the vaccine could cause problems in the elderly population?
So what's interesting is the trials that were studied in, they were studied in people up to age 75. So it's unlikely based on the science that we have thus far that there'll be any adverse effects. I definitely think the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the risks in this population.
Is there anything else that we need to know from, let's say, an ethical perspective?
So the ethics of this can be seen also on a societal level. The question comes up, do we have the goal to directly prevent death, or do we have the goal to prevent spread?
So there's also a question of who is in the category of essential workers in the first round. Is it just people in hospitals, or does it apply to all of the CDC-defined essential workers, which is about 70% of the workforce?
Well, that's true. If it specifically applies to healthcare workers, it might not do enough to control the spread of COVID. But if it applied to everyone defined as essential workers, we might not reasonably be able to vaccinate everyone in the first round. I think our time's up. Do you have any other parting words?
I know this past year has been difficult and we've been living through a global pandemic unlike anything we've seen for a century. Our healthcare system has had its shining moments of love and compassion, but it has also shown how fragile it truly is. We've missed weddings and funerals, and we've seen our country more politically divided than we've seen in decades. And through it all, we've seen people come together to try to help one another. Difficult, honestly, barely begins to describe it, but a working vaccine is the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever get back to normal, and I honestly don't know if we really want to. We know how much we've lost, but we've gained a lot. Hope we can use what we've learned in this year to go forward rather than backwards. This year, the entire country saw how important it is that everyone have access to health care. We also saw how much society relies on people in some of the lowest paying jobs like grocery store employees and cleaning staff. We've grown so much throughout this crisis, and hopefully we'll have the virus under control. We can take what we've learned and end up a better society than we had before.
Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast.
Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
You're listening. You're listening. You're listening. You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now become a member now.